This is side two, side one of tape two of the ongoing oral history interview with Emeritus Professor Stanley Payne. Stan, when you came in 1968, what was your research program at that time?
I was very busy my first years in Wisconsin because I had two projects underway from the last year or two at UCLA. The first of these was really changed my outlook on contemporary Spanish history. Was an invitation from Jack Green at Johns Hopkins to write a volume in a series of 10 volumes that he was editing on revolutions in the modern world. Green was a noted specialist in the American Revolution and was going to do the American volume. He had identified 10 revolutions and suggested to me that I write a book on the Spanish Revolution, that is, during the Spanish Civil War. This seemed to me quite a good idea, and so I undertook the project and began work on it basically in 1966. I had also one lucky break on that, which came about serendipitously, in that in 1965, the San Diego campus at La Jolla, University of California, became for the first time a full-scale university campus. It had been a specialized marine and science campus down to that time. The first chancellor was John Galbraith, my colleague in British Empire history at UCLA. And so he was starting up a whole series of new academic departments from scratch, was looking for a history chairman. And I recommended to him Gabriel Jackson, who was the only other person older than myself and who had begun working in contemporary Spanish history, then teaching at Knox College in Illinois, and had just published a very attractive book on the Spanish Republican Civil War. So Galbraith hired him, and Jackson became the founding chairman of the department at San Diego, really a man not cut out for administration. So the first thing he did after becoming chairman was to hire someone else to become the regular continuing chairman. But he, since there was more money in the 60s, he arranged for the library to purchase the private collection of an American political activist in Morocco who had collected a good deal of material on the Spanish Civil War and the Spanish Revolution. So that was deposited in the San Diego Library in 1967, my last year at UCLA, so I was able to exploit this very thoroughly before leaving Southern California. And that really helped a good deal with the research on that book. So I was writing the book on the Spanish Revolution at that time. I was able to take the fall quarter of 67 on leave at UCLA. So I was doing research in Europe and in Spain on that fall of 67. And I was just finishing the writing of the book on the Spanish Revolution when I came to Wisconsin in 1968. Curiously, this is still the only book with the title of the Spanish Revolution that deals with the entire revolutionary process of Spain from 1931 to 1939, and went through, in fact, two different Spanish translations. So that several years removed, two different Barcelona publishers brought it out in Spanish. Shows you how loose the Spanish publishing industry is. I did not even know about the second one because there was an agent involved in the series, and his papers were apparently not in order, and so he sold the book twice. But this caused no unnecessary complications, apparently, and so that's the way it was. The book was also eventually translated into Japanese as well.
Really?
And it was, as I say, really a very important project for me, because I had accepted the general politically correct notion out of that time that the Spanish left had been fundamentally democratic through the Republic and that the Civil War in Spain was a struggle between fascism and democracy. And I found the degree to which the Spanish left, even the moderate left, had flouted democratic norms even before the Civil War. This changed my perspective on Spanish history. So that was one of the two projects. And the other one was that shortly before leaving UCLA, I received a letter from Norman Cantor, the noted, rather maverick medievalist, I think that would be a fair way to describe Cantor, who was the history editor for a New York firm called Thomas Crowell, an old New York publisher, soon, in fact, to be bought out, though I didn't know that, saying it was very important for their list to have a one-volume history of Spain and Portugal. Would I not like to write that?
Hmm.
I thought about that. That would be a good thing to do. There was no new, up-to-date history of Spain and Portugal in English at all. And I thought this would be an interesting thing to do. In fact, it was in the preparation of this book, this history, that I really learned Spanish history. It's one thing to teach a course. You only have to generate a certain amount of material to give a series of lectures. But to write a thorough and complete history of the Iberian Peninsula, one had to do a lot more reading than I had never done. And so it was really to write that history of Spain and Portugal that I really learned Spanish history, I can say, for the first time. Remember that I had never had a course on Spanish history, and I had simply been working up my own research and then preparing my lectures for my course on my own. So this was also a very important project, and it was also the project that began my association with the University of Wisconsin Press. I devoted that semester on leave in 1969 when I first came to Wisconsin to pressing ahead with the history of Spain and Portugal, and in fact during that spring and summer very nearly completed that book, though I'd still be working on it still for another year and a half more until about the beginning of 1971. And when I completed my 950-page manuscript, so obviously it was a big book.
Yeah, I was wondering how you would do that in one volume.
I sent it off to Crowell. He said, thank you very much. Nothing happened for the next 3 months. And it so happened at this point, it was like in the spring of 1971, the end of my third year in Wisconsin, I happened to be introduced to Tom Webb, the longtime director of the Wisconsin Press, at a party. And as one does with publishers, begin to talk about books. I said, well, you know, I've just finished this long history of Spain and Portugal. I've sent it off to the publisher, and they acknowledged receipt, but they haven't sent me a single word about their plans and schedule for publication, or the editing of the manuscript, or anything. This strikes me as very peculiar, does it not you? Tom Webb said, yes, indeed. Maybe this no longer interests them, but what is not of interest to a commercial publisher would be very interesting to the Wisconsin Press. So I wrote them a letter asking if they really intended to publish the book, and I found, in fact, that the year before, Crowell had been bought up by Dun & Bradstreet. And they had a new commercial policy. They wanted to publish blockbusters. And they said that since they had a contract, they would undoubtedly publish the book sometime, but maybe not for a long time. So they would be happy to release me from my contract if I would return the advance of $2,000 or $3,000 that they had given me out of the first year's royalties. I said, fine. Signed a contract with the Wisconsin Press. Wisconsin brought it out as two volumes, the history of Spain and Portugal, in two volumes in the spring of 1973, and remained in then later in a paperback edition, and remained in press with the Wisconsin, remained in print. Wisconsin Press for about 10 or 15 years. It finally went out of print sometime during the course of the 1980s, and it became an alternate selection of the History Book Club. And then, of course, was eventually published in Spanish as well. So that also was a very important project and something that I was working on quite actively during my first years at Wisconsin. I don't think, however, that I completely answered the question on the last tape about personalities in the department when I came in the late 60s and early 70s. Certainly, in their own way, George Massey and Harvey Goldberg, who we've talked about, were major and dominant personalities, and I was very close to George, and simply on good terms with Harvey. Of course, the people in African history were very important, very influential, had lots of money. Then another person who played a very active role at that time is someone now largely forgotten, though there is an award in his name in the Latin American program, and this was the founder of Latin American History in Wisconsin, John Letty Phelan. John Phelan was a remarkable scholar. I had met him, in fact, when I was in Minnesota, because he was a close friend of one of the younger historians there and had come over for Thanksgiving. And he'd started his career in Milwaukee. So I met him in 61 in Minneapolis when he was teaching in Milwaukee. And Madison hired him from Milwaukee, a very good choice, because he began the program as a specialist in colonial Latin American history, and then created the triadic structure that the Latin American program would have from that time on. That is, one specialist in colonial Latin America, one in Brazil, and one in modern Spanish-speaking Latin America. Then hired Tom Skidmore in 1966. As the Brazilianist, and Peter Smith as modern Spanish-speaking Latin America in 1968. And that created a very strong Latin American program. In fact, as strong, I would say, in quality as any other in the country at that time. And Wisconsin has remained very strong in Latin America from that point all the way down to the present. Phelan was a bachelor and very active in departmental politics. In fact, after Mort Rothstein was the chair from 69 to 72, and then Al Bogue served only 1 year as chairman, 72 to 73, then left the chairmanship early because of health problems. Ted Hammer was chair from 73 to 76. Then John Phelan lobbied very vigorously for the appointment of the youngest chairman probably in the history of the department in recent times, Peter Smith in 1976. Smith was chair from 76 to 79, though Phelan suddenly died of a stroke right after that, at a very early age of only about 52 years in 1976. But Phelan was an important person in the department, very active in a variety of ways, and a remarkable scholar, because each of his four books was about a completely different part of Latin American colonial or Spanish Empire history.
Excuse me.
And of course, other strong personalities were developing in other areas, such as Kemal Karpat, who came a few years before I did, in Ottoman history, would be the senior person in the whole Middle Eastern history program. And then Bob Frickenberg in the history of India, who came several years before I did. Of course, appointees in East Asian history as well, so that the department really had quite a broad and strong faculty overall in world history, even though the American history program no longer had the distinction that it had, say, 10 years earlier.
I want to go back to you were talking about your book on Spain and Portugal. And you said you had never really had a course, per se, in Spanish history. When you did your research on to produce this book, what did you learn that was new to you, that you had not known?
The general history of Spain and Portugal? Uh-huh. Well, simply an awful lot of things. Remember that I had never had to pass any kind of exam in Spanish history. So that my reading in early Spanish history had been desultory. I was an autodidact, and I simply developed specific material for specific lectures when I began to teach the course. Mm-hmm. So to really develop a complete grounding in all areas was something that I did for the first time starting in 1967, mm-hmm. when I began to do the very broad program of reading that I did for this book, that is to learn the ancient history of the peninsula, which I had scattered this, and then to learn all the major phases of medieval history as well as the 16th century. And also to learn really the history of Portugal, because I had not been teaching the history of Portugal. So I learned the history of Portugal absolutely from scratch. In the Spanish edition, in fact, the Portuguese part was published separately as a brief history of Portugal. And some of my Spanish friends who read that book said that they enjoyed it particularly because it was the only book on Portuguese history they'd ever read, which shows, of course, how much attention Spaniards have typically paid to the history of neighboring Portugal. So it was a matter of getting a really full grounding in Spanish history, not just for... One can teach courses with only a certain amount of knowledge of the material, but to really understand all phases of the history, to write then a comprehensive and authoritative history about it, one has to fill in lots and lots of gaps. So I filled in all the gaps here for the first time.
After you did that work, on Spain and Portugal. Did it have any kind of lasting impact on your research on the Spanish Civil War and your research into the Spanish Republic and the Franco era?
It did, in the sense of giving me a broader perspective and making it possible for me to situate Spanish history in comparative terms, because now I knew so much more about it. And I think that one of the stronger features of my work from the early 1970s on was that I tried to some extent always not to do Spanish history in a vacuum, but to place it also in comparative perspective. I was well prepared in modern European history, but then to have the two different parts of the equation come together, I had to know more about Spanish history first, and then I could use them in a comparative dimension in everything that I've done on Spain in roughly, say, the last 35 years. Another thing that did, of course, was to give me really a sense of Portugal. I visited Portugal very briefly in the spring of 1959, but just to take a quick look at the country, because I had to hurry back to Madrid to finish my work in Madrid. Really had not learned anything about Portugal. I remember I bought one book on Portuguese history, on the Portuguese Revolution of 1910, in Madrid that year, and found it incomprehensible, because I had no background. And it was not really a very well-written book either. In fact, this new grounding in Portugal led to an important initiative just as I was publishing the history of Spain and Portugal. At the close of the academic year 71-72, the head of the new European Studies program told those of us who were on his steering committee that there was about $700 left over in the budget. And of course, as in a typical bureaucratic enterprise, we should spend that this year, else it would be lost forever. What would be worth doing? I said, well, you know, a West European country that has never studied is Portugal. We have no group focusing on Portugal. And I would propose that I would call a very quick conference to be held within the next 45 days before the academic year totally ends. It would be June 1972, here in Madison, bringing together the few people who are interested in contemporary Portugal from the point of view of history and the social sciences. Hmm. And so by collecting also a few hundred dollars from the Latin American program, which always had more money, I was able to bring five people together in Madison in the June of 1972. We organized something which we called the Conference Group on Modern Portugal, and held our first conference at the University of New Hampshire a year and a half later in autumn, October 1973. And we're fortunate also at that time to have someone in the form of Douglas Wheeler, basically at first an Africanist historian who had co-authored a book on Angola and now wanted to study Portugal itself rather than Portuguese Africa, as the secretary of the conference group, who kept that job for the next 30 years. So that the conference group then became the only group in North America, the English-speaking world, perhaps the only one aside from the Instituto de Estudos Portugueses in the École des Instituts in Paris, that focused specifically on Portugal, and held a series of conferences, published a series of books, and eventually by the 1990s launched a new journal, the Portuguese Studies Review. Mm-hmm. So this enabled me to take the initiative in really putting Portuguese studies on the map in the United States for the first time.
Portugal has always fascinated me, and I suppose this is a digression. I've always wondered how Portugal came to be. It's so odd to me. It seems like it should be part of Spain, doesn't it?
Well, this is what, of course, the Spanish have always maintained. Answer to the riddle has to do, of course, it began really with a kind of political regional particularism of the sort that was very common in the Middle Ages. There were lots of little kingdoms in the Middle Ages. The Portuguese kingdom began in 1128 in the way that various other Spanish and European kingdoms began at that time, simply with its own separate dynasty and a political structure, but managed to sustain its independence. And it wasn't so much the way that it began, because there was nothing really very special in its origins, but simply the fact that it managed to hold together that eventually historically created an identity and a separate set of institutions that really did not exist in the beginning. That is, in the beginning, the Kingdom of Portugal had the same kind of institutions that one would find particularly in León or Castile or other Spanish kingdoms. And in its social structure, its culture, its institutions, was less different from the rest of Spain than, for example, Catalonia was, Catalonia being much more like Italy. But because of the political and military reality of having maintained its independence, it did create an identity and develop for itself a kind of historical mission. And except for a period of 60 years in the 16th and 17th centuries, managed to maintain its independence, and the process, of course, became a strongly independent country that tended to look away from the rest of the peninsula and rely from the 17th century on its alliance with England, and so maintained its independence and became, of course, a very singular kind of culture. And it's always been a kind of a frustration to me that I never got back to Portugal and really did any major work on that again after the history of Spain and Portugal together. But on the other hand, there seem to be so many more important things to do either in Spain or in modern European history generally, particularly on the topic of fascism, that although I've returned to Portugal many times, I never undertook another major research project on Portugal.
Well, it's not too late, is it?
It's not too late, but there's still many other things to do. Portugal always gets shoved farther down the priority list. When we held our first conference of the conference group in New Hampshire in October 73, the Portuguese sociologist Hermínio Martins, who made his career at Oxford, presented a paper and said that Portugal is the land of the negative superlative. What he meant by that was that in references to Portugal in comparative terms, whereas people talking about most countries like to say that such and such is the most, the leading, etc., the idea always was that Portugal was the least prosperous, the least developed West European country, the most backward, the one with the highest level of illiteracy and so forth, so that it had become, in the 20th century, among Western European countries, the land of the negative superlative. And I like to call it the Rodney Dangerfield of countries, the country that just don't get no respect. This has been, to some extent, the fate of Portuguese studies, though Portuguese history has continued to be cultivated to a small degree, and the Portuguese Studies Review, like the older journal that we founded in Madison, which started as a literary review, then became a literary and historical and social science studies review, the Luso-Brazilian Review, always continues to get material about Portugal. And indeed, I should mention in that regard that the Luso-Brazilian Review, which was begun by Lloyd Gaston in the mid-60s in the Spanish and Portuguese department, and then 10 years later, about 1976, became a multidisciplinary review, not just literature. It has been the Portuguese language culture review that I worked on most, because I was the social studies co-editor about 5 years, roughly about 1986 to 1991, and I remained on the board of editors that time down to the present. And so I spent a lot of time working with the Luso-Brazilian Review as a Wisconsin publication particularly, though, of course, in that journal, Portuguese studies take second half to Brazilian studies. And sometimes we've had a bit of trouble in keeping that journal afloat, but we've always managed to do so. I should say a word or two, perhaps, about the Spanish and Portuguese department in this regard. The Spanish department at Wisconsin has been a strong department from the 1920s. And one of the features of the Spanish department has been that it always paid a certain amount of attention to Portuguese literature, and always had people in Portuguese literature. The Portuguese studies were rather stronger in literature in Wisconsin than most other places. When I came in 68, the Spanish department had been strong for more than four decades and was dominated by Iberians, particularly at the senior ranks, that is, the most illustrious scholars were people like Diego Catalan, the Spanish philologist who was a grandson of the noted Menéndez Pidal, or Sánchez Romerales, one or two others, Jorge de Sena, in Portuguese literature. These were the people who really were the luminaries of the Spanish and Portuguese department, they all came from Spain and Portugal.
Hmm.
All four of them were hired away by different branches of the University of California, minor branches of California, that could afford to provide greater emoluments: San Diego, Santa Cruz, Davis. So that within 5 years they were all gone. And then, of course, some of the leading people were Latin Americanists and others. But it was a unique feature of the Spanish and Portuguese department that the main scholars at that time were Iberians, and then also, of course, the very noted Lithuanian Hispanist, Birutė Ciplijauskaitė, who was, in fact, after that, probably the leading single scholar in the department during the decades of the 70s and 80s until her retirement in the 90s.
Hmm. Oh, interesting. Stan, can we talk a little bit about your development into probably one of the nation's leading scholars in Spanish fascism? And what John Tortorici has said about you is that your work as a revisionist historian of understanding modern Spanish history is really exceptional and very prominent. Can you talk a little bit about how your research led you and what findings you were making and what you were publishing that drew such attention to your interpretation of the Spanish Franco period?
Let me give you a brief overview of all of that, and then I'll talk about some of these things in detail. The topic of the founder of the fascist party in Spain, José Antonio Pino de Rivera, and the Falangist movement was suggested to me, as I mentioned, by Hubert Herring at Claremont.
Mm-hmm.
And so this became the first book, and then Vicente Fibi suggested the topic of the military, and I wrote the book on the politics of the modern Spanish army, published in 67. These books could not be published in Spain, published by Ruedo Iberico, but they circulated very widely,
mm-hmm.
and gave me a considerable reputation, not merely in American academic circles, but within Spain also. So that well before the end of the Franco regime, I had enjoyed some reputation inside Spain. I published a little book for Kroll in 67 called Franco Spain, which is kind of a take of Spain in the mid-late 60s, a very brief 130-page book, which was my third Spanish book. But what began to change things, as I suggested, was the work on the Spanish Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And what I found there was that things were quite different on the left than I had been led to believe. I had accepted pretty much the standard notion that the Spanish Civil War was a conflict between fascism and democracy, though I knew that there were revolutionary excesses on the leftist side. But what I found, of course, was that the Spanish left had largely abandoned what we would call democracy before the Civil War began, and that, in fact, this abandonment of democracy and the pre-revolutionary pressures on the system were really the general cause of the Civil War, even though the immediate cause was simply the revolt of part of the Spanish army in July 1936. So that these findings were first presented in the Spanish Revolution book in 1970, though not in the sense of presenting any kind of major thesis or doing polemical kind of history, simply recording the facts. As I mentioned, that book was then appeared in several different translations, two in Spanish and one in Japanese. Then I was involved in really learning Spanish history and developing more of an in-depth perspective in the general history of Spain and Portugal, and moved in a variety of different directions. I moved, in a sense, kind of sideways in the 1970s, because the next book was a book on early Basque nationalism, which was prepared during the last years of the Franco regime, when this was shaping up as one of the major political problems of Spain, though I had no idea, of course, the extent of which this would create a long-lived terrorist movement and become the number one political issue in the country later on. My book, published in 1975 with the University of Nevada Press as part of its Basque series, was simply a political history of early Basque nationalism, basically from the 1890s down to 1937. And so that was kind of a sideways move, which I would say didn't deepen any of the major issues, but simply provided the first new scholarly study in the area of what are called the micro-nationalisms, or in Spanish, the peripheral nationalisms, which became a major topic after 1975. So it later became a hot topic, but I only developed it to a certain degree in the early 70s, and then really abandoned that topic after that time. And I've always had the tendency to move to some extent back and forth between Spanish history and modern European history generally, so that in the late 70s, I spent a good deal of time away from Spain, developing my first journal book, trying to achieve a clear conceptualization and interpretation of European fascism in general. That was the project of the late 1970s, and it was published by the Wisconsin Press in 1980. And in fact, it was a rather difficult thing to do, because if it had not been for the encouragement of George Massey, and also the encouragement of Tom Webb as the director of the press, I might not really have pushed that through to a conclusion. Then that came out in 1980 while I was chairman of the department, from 79 to 82. While chairman, I could not, of course, be away for any kind of research projects. But one always has a certain amount of extra time to read. And so as chairman, I cast about for a project that I thought I could handle within the parameters of the chairman's duties, and decided to try to write an overview historically of Spanish Catholicism, which was based strictly on the secondary literature. See, I would simply sit at home and read when I was not busy with the chairmanship, and work up the material for an overview of Spanish Catholicism, which then was published in 1983.
This concludes side one of tape two. This is side two of tape two, Stanley Payne.
So that the overview of the history of Spanish Catholicism came out in 1983 in Wisconsin Press, and was something published in Spanish, and recently has appeared in a second Spanish edition in 2005, a rather fancy edition of reprints, since it was published with Planeta, the largest publisher in Spain, with a slight updating down to the first years of the 21st century. And then I thought that I was going to complete my work on the Franco regime by doing a general history of the Franco regime in the mid-1980s. It's a project that I worked on basically from 1982-83 to 86. And had been offered a contract, in fact, by a Spanish publisher to do a history of the regime several years earlier, around 1979 or 80. I had rejected that because I thought it was simply too early, but by the mid-80s I was ready to do it. And so I then published the history of the Franco regime, a very sizable volume with the Wisconsin Press in 87, and that, of course, was then also brought out in Spanish, behest of one of the Spanish publishers. I even converted it into a short biography of Franco on the occasion of the centenary of his birth in 1992. Mm. So that I thought that really would be the end of my work on the Spanish aspect of fascism. But this turned out not to be the case, because after developing the big book of the general history of fascism, which is a separate topic that I'll take up later on, when I was in Spain in the summer of 95, one of the leading publishers offered me a contract to redo my dissertation book, in effect. Something that a few other people, like Gerda Lerner, have already done. So I turned that into a much bigger, up-to-date book on the Spanish fascist movement. And that, in turn, was published in 99 in English also by the Wisconsin Press, and then was the winner of the first Elizabeth Steinberg Prize awarded by the press in 2004. So that I ended up doing a good deal more work on Spanish fascism, the history of the Franco regime, than I'd ever intended, doing the general history of the regime in 87, and then in the late 90s, a really complete history of the movement from even before 1931, from 1923 down to its very end in 1977. I would not say that those books were strikingly revisionist, except that they brought out the full complexities and also the different notes and tones and changes in the regime and in the movement over the course of its long history. What John Todorisi is referring to is several other things, some of my more recent Spanish publications. During the late 70s and early 80s, I formed a part of a flying circus of American academics who participated in a variety of conferences and programs about the dramatic Spanish democratization that took place after Franco. Mm-hmm. There were so few political scientists who worked on Spain that an historian like myself had to function as a surrogate political scientist. So I was in lots of conferences, contributed many volumes and studies during that time, and also edited for the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations a book called The Politics of Democratic Spain, which came out in 1986. By the end of the decade, it was clear that the democratization was successful. Whereas the Second Republic that gave rise to the Civil War of 1936 had been a disastrous failure. Why was that? It seemed to me, therefore, that by the end of the 1980s, the time had come for a new look at the first attempt at democracy in Spain, the Republic of 1931. Why had things gone so wrong? If the Republic was such a blissful democracy, as its proponents like to claim, how could it all have collapsed in civil war? Blissful democracies do not collapse in civil wars. There's something wrong here. So I decided to write a one-volume history of the Republic from 1931 to 36. And so that became the volume called Spain's First Democracy, the Second Republic, 1931 to 36. This was published in English by the Wisconsin Press, my next to last Wisconsin book, and then, of course, also in Spanish. And the analysis that it presented the Republic was quite different, not a blissful democracy, but in fact a political system of extreme fragmentation and polarization, which had very few Democrats. Not Democrats particularly on the right, but not Democrats on the left either. In fact, only a small minority center really interested in democracy. So then it became quite doubtful that democracy was overthrown in Spain by the military rebellion of 1936. In fact, it had largely ceased to function before the rebellion began. I did not present this thesis in any very strongly polemical way. These were simply conclusions we drawn from the book. In fact, later on, I decided to revisit this whole problem with two new books that I prepared at the end of the 90s going into the 21st century. One was another look at the revolution from the point of view of communism and the Soviet connection, because the opening of the Soviet archives had provided some direct Soviet documentation about what was really going on that we'd never had before. And then also to look at the end of the Republic, the final phase of the Republic, in a much more detailed fashion, and see what was going on that led directly to that collapse. So this became two books that I published in English with Yale, which became my new main American publisher, and of course also in Spanish, a book on the Soviet Union, the Spanish Civil War, and Communism, which is has a more exact title in Spanish, which really dealt with Spanish communism from 1931 to 1939, and particularly the Civil War. I think provided the first full and objective account of what really went on with communism and the Soviet intervention in the Spanish Civil War. And curiously, in the year 2005, won the Marshall Shulman Award of the American Association of Slavic Studies, which I was quite gratified with, because Hispanists normally don't win awards from Slavic Studies associations.
Although you did mention earlier that when you were at your undergraduate school, you were thinking about Russian history. So
this was the opportunity to bring the two together. I had finally studied Russian a certain amount, although I read Russian with great difficulty with the use of a dictionary, and then I cannot simply work easily in it as I can in a West European language. But that made it possible to bring the two together in what I think was quite a successful book on the character of communism and revolution in Spain and the Soviet role. Was the next book, we call The Collapse of the Spanish Republic, dealt with the second half of the Republic, concentrating particularly on the last 5 months and how the whole thing came apart. And what is revisionist, particularly about that book, Michael Villon has had the greatest revisionist impact of any of my books, was the fact that it showed that Spanish democracy had really come apart before the Civil War began, but in fact the issue was democracy, and that if the Republic had continued to remain a functioning democracy, there would have been no Civil War, because the Spanish are not totally irrational people. If you have a functioning democracy, you're probably not going to try to destroy it. It doesn't make any sense. It was really the breakdown of the system before the Civil War began that really led to the Civil War. Though neither side in the Civil War intended to replace the Republic with a genuine democracy. That had now gone by the boards. It's a different issue. But it was particularly that book, more than any other single one, that has had a very considerable revisionist impact inside Spain, particularly since the Spanish left has made of the Republican Civil War a new political issue in the 21st century, the way it was not in the 1970s and 80s, and has tried to derive political advantage from that. The question has become, therefore, quite a salient one, not just in scholarly circles, but in Spanish public affairs generally in the last few years. That's why I did so many interviews during the last 10 days of November when I was last in Spain.
I was going to ask, are you quite a public intellectual figure in Spain?
Well, I have always been to a minor degree, and this has sort of ratcheted up enormously in the last few years because of these most recent publications, so that now I've become, in effect, an active public intellectual in a way in which I was just an occasional one, or a more recondite scholarly one prior to about the beginning of the 21st century. So this is what has happened to me in my old age, so to speak.
Are you the subject of vigorous dissent or criticism?
Oh, yes. These issues are very polarized now in Spain, to a greater degree than any other European country. There is really no analogy to the extent to which recent history has become highly polemical in Spain in the last 5 years. And, of course, there is a politically correct version which dominates the universities, although there's also a very vigorous independent Spanish press, and in the newspapers and in the publishing houses, and among independent scholars, there is considerable dissent to that. And I am one of the dissenters from the now the official established politically correct version.
I know that you have made several references to the fact that you and George Mossy were friends. Did you and he do a lot of work together on this? Did you discuss your work on Spanish fascism? And before he died, did you have a chance to talk about the Second Republic of Spain?
Well, George and I, over a period of 31 years, talked a very great deal. And we talked about all kinds of things, but we certainly talked about modern European history. And, of course, the single topic of discussion there more than any other had to do with fascism.
Uh-huh.
Probably we talked more about Germany than we did about Spain. We had put together, for example, about 3 years after I came to Madison, a visiting scholars colloquium on fascism around 1971, in which we invited a variety of people to discuss different aspects and different examples of European fascism. So this was always a main focus of the conversation and work of George and I. And we talked about these things a very great deal. As I mentioned earlier, it was George who encouraged me to develop the first general book that I did on fascism, published in 1980, the one that's called Fascism, Comparison and Definition, which tried to provide a unified interpretation of fascism and a kind of definition of fascism. Now, you might say, well, so what? This is a major topic, surely that had been done. The curious thing about fascism, however, was that for many years after the end of World War II, though historians were doing all kinds of research and publication about individual aspects of fascist movements, one of the major topics in the scholarly and publication world, there was really no agreement about what's called the concept of generic fascism, whether there was a general phenomenon that one could broadly call fascism, as distinct from National Socialism in Germany, fascism in Italy, Falangism in Spain, and so on. We did develop considerable debate about this in the 1960s and 70s, in a series of conferences, some of which I participated in, and yet These conferences, though they resulted in the publication of new volumes, did not present, in any case, a unified overall interpretation of fascism. What it was as a specific historical phenomenon, if it existed as a general phenomenon, rather than a series of completely separate representations, which did not amount to any kind of unified general phenomenon, and how you would define it. When I had done the first book, the dissertation book on Spanish fascism, I had no question about subtitling it A History of Spanish Fascism, but in fact it was only a history of the first 10 years of Spanish fascism. But if you'd asked me what was fascism generally, why was this Spanish fascism, all I would have been able to have done would have given you several rather vague general ideas as to what this was about. And the first couple of essays I tried to write about this later on in the late 60s and early 70s were not particularly successful, and in fact were not published. Two of my three particular unpublished papers that were rejected in the course of my career were about this, and I think correctly so, because I was trying to think my way through it. But George encouraged me, and then later on Tom Webb did. And I finally knuckled down in the late 70s to try to write a book which was not a history. That is, fascism, comparison and definition, is not a history of fascism. It's really more of a political science type book. What do we mean by fascism? What were its cultural, intellectual, political origins? What were its principal manifestations? What were the features that these have in common? What conclusions can we draw from them in general? How would we define any common phenomenon such as fascism? And how much is left of it historically and politically after the fascist era? So it was these analytical issues that I was trying to deal with, not historical description, not historical research. And that book was published in 1980 and was generally quite successful. I think it's gone out of print now in English. There's been a recent reprinting just this fall of the Spanish edition, which has sold more than 20,000 copies. And then took its place, really, as probably the first reasonably successful effort to provide a unified definition and interpretation of European fascism. It was not a history. So that, in fact, later on in the early 90s, after I'd finished the book on Spain's first democracy, the general history of the Second Republic, I was talking to George, I don't know what I'll do next. George said, why don't you write a big history book about fascism? I said, well, I'd been possibly thinking of doing that. So with George's encouragement, I developed a book which was much more of a history of fascism. This became the big book that was published by Wisconsin in 95, called A History of Fascism, 1914-1945, which had all of the analytical and interpretive features of the first book. In fact, even more elaborately developed than the first book, but also a history of the principal fascist movements and in capsule form of the German and Italian regimes. It was both an interpretation and an analysis and also a general history of fascism. That has also been quite successful with editions in Spanish, in Italian, and in German. And Ullstein has brought out, in fact, just in 2006, a cut-rate cloth-bound edition of a very big book, a 700-page book, for €15.95, which is very cheap by European standards. So the general history of fascism has been, I think, broadly successful as well. But this was the sort of thing that really was a product also of the formal and informal, more informal than formal, collaboration with George Massey over a long period of time.
Mm-hmm. Stan, this is a digression, but I wonder if you're concerned in contemporary political discourse how easily and casually the term fascist is, or fascism is thrown around.
Well, one throws up one's hands at this sort of thing. I participate every couple of years in a long talk show with Milt Rosenberg of WGN in Chicago, and we talk about this kind of thing. Fascism, of course, has become the favorite political majority of everybody. And it's used so frequently as a general majority that all it really indicates in most cases is that the person strongly disapproves of whatever it is that he is calling fascist.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't really tell you anything necessarily about what this thing is that is called fascist. So we have fascists as different as Ronald Reagan, George Bush, Margaret Thatcher, whoever it might be, anyone that anyone is opposed to. Similarly, we have this business of Islamofascism, which I think is also a different kind of abuse of the term fascism, though it makes somewhat more sense in that case. Fascism became the favorite all-purpose political pejorative of the 20th century, particularly in the second half of the 20th century. And this was the case particularly because the word itself, outside of Italian, doesn't really mean anything. Liberalism is about liberty. Democracy is supposedly about the demos, the rule of the people. Well, fascism is about fasce. What does that tell you? You see, if you don't speak Italian, it doesn't really mean anything at all. And I think because the term itself is so indeterminate in its fundamental word, that it's more easily used as an all-purpose pejorative. It doesn't really have to mean anything specific. Simply something very reprehensible, whatever that may be. So, and also the fact that with the double sibilance, fascist is a rather sinister-sounding word that also makes it more useful as an all-purpose pejorative. So one simply gives up at any possibility of the term being used with any kind of analytical or intellectual precision.
Stan, I'd like to refocus your attention now on the climate at UW-Madison when you first came here in 1968, which in some senses would be the worst possible time for a new professor to come to the campus because of the turmoil here. Or perhaps not.
No, well, it was, in fact. 1968-69 was the most tense year of my first 3 years in Madison, in general. Although the worst incident, of course, occurred 2 years later, in August 1970, with the Sterling Hall bombing. I was shielded from it the first year because I taught two small courses, an advanced upper division course in Spanish history and a graduate pro seminar. So I didn't have to deal with large numbers of students. And then the second semester, I was on leave. The first instance of this tension that I saw came at the all-department reception held in the union at the beginning of the semester in 1968, which Dave Cronin, the chairman, had asked George Mossy to address the department and the students, because George was basically a man of the moderate left, but not a radical, didn't really approve of the radicals, but someone whom the radicals could talk to, and he thought that George was the kind of prestigious, responsible professor who could bridge things over and might be able to make a common appeal to rally everyone together at the beginning of the academic year. The theme of George's very brief remarks, which only lasted about 10 minutes, was that, in fact, there's not left-wing scholarship or right-wing scholarship, there's only good scholarship or bad scholarship, which was exactly correct, absolutely correct. Nothing could be more accurate than what George said, but this was the only time I've ever seen George Mossy give a public address that failed. It fell flat. It did not impress the radicals, who formed a large part of the graduate students, and there was no response. That was the end of the talk, and things simply went their merry way with sit-ins in departmental meetings, but no massive incidents affecting the history department in general during 1968-69. This finally came around to touch me at the end of my third semester, the third semester being the first semester of 1969-70. I was teaching that year the survey course in recent European history and had two teaching assistants. And about the 1st of December, early December, because we were on a different kind of schedule in those years in which the semester didn't end until mid-January. In early December, it turned out that student radicalism was turning a new leaf in that the activists of STS, the Students for Democratic Society, were beginning to think about their futures and their careers, and they were tired of being arrested in student demonstrations, and they wanted STS to adopt a somewhat more moderate and responsible profile on campus, whereas a minority dissented and wanted to begin a new initiative, which they decided to begin at that point, just before the Christmas break in December 1969, by trying to make political addresses to large classes of students in the classroom at the beginning of classes. And so on one occasion, I was delayed by a long-distance phone call in my office and got down to class in the second floor of the Humanities Building a minute late, and found the class had been taken over by a group of SDS people who were haranguing the students. And so I turned on my heel, but was originally very quickly caught up with by plainclothes campus policemen who had been following the SDS of activists from class to class for several hours, but had not been able to obtain the correct conditions in which they could be brought to authority for disrupting classes. They told me I should simply go in and indicate who were addressing the class and disrupting the class, and they would arrest them. I did, and three of the four of them were. And that ended that entire offensive, in fact, by SDS in December 1969. Though it also meant that the more radical of my two teaching assistants called me a pig and walked out and resigned his TA-ship for the remainder of the semester. Apparently, I don't know whether he collected the money or not. Things were so loose at that time, possibly he did. But I had to grade his papers at the end of the semester, so I had to do a little extra work at that time. But as a result, entirely beyond any plan which I would ever have had in mind, I had no idea this was going on 10 minutes before it happened. I was instrumental in taking the action which brought an end to SDS on campus. Because then the radicals broke away from SDS and formed their own activist organization, the Mother Jones Society, which became the radical successor to SDS, but was smaller and less active. And so that particular incident in the Humanities Building in December 1969 was a turning point, with the arrest of three of the four SDSers who were disrupting the class at the beginning of class. And it really meant that radical politics then entered a new chapter on campus, and one in which, in fact, most of the former SDS students became more moderate. It was a different group of people the following August in 1970, who then carried out the Stirling Hall bombing. People who really had not been SDS activists. And the result of that was that the student radicals at the beginning of the fall semester of 1970 absolutely settled down. Academic 70-71 was more or less a normal year, with the exception of the...
Really?
Yes, pretty much a normal year compared to the two preceding years, because that traumatized much of student radicalism. There was much less activist pressure, nothing in the classroom. I don't mean generally, classrooms were not normally affected anyway, but generally the atmosphere was much more tranquil on campus during academic 70-71 than it had been either of the three or four preceding years. This was the cathartic effect of the Stirling Hall bombing. It really took the wind out of the sails of radical agitation, so that department meetings, classes, various kinds of activities really did not see radical pressure to speak of in 70-71 at all, compared with the preceding years. It was, in fact, a turning point.
Mm-hmm. Were you on campus when the Stirling Hall bombing happened?
I was sleeping tranquilly in my home, barely 2 miles west of campus, and didn't hear it. My wife was awakened by it. She heard some loud noise around 4 a.m. It did not wake me up. So I was here, not teaching. I have never taught summer school in Wisconsin. I always did at UCLA. So that this has been one of the pleasant things about Wisconsin. I was never in a circumstance to have to teach summer school. But I was here, certainly working on my own work that summer, the time the bombing took place. But it definitely had a cathartic effect.
This concludes side two of tape two.